From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. As New Yorkers prepared for a Halloween parade in Greenwich Village Tuesday, a driver in a rented Home Depot truck drove down a busy bike path, mowing down bikers and pedestrians, and crashed into a school bus in Lower Manhattan. 8 people died, a dozen were injured, a number critically. The suspect is described as a fervent ISIS follower and followed the ISIS playbook to a T, finding a soft target, attacking. And this comes 1 month after the deadly Las Vegas shooting. This hour on Point, terrorism and soft targets. Do we have to live with this? You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What have you been thinking since this attack about New York, public places, your town, the odds of being hit by a terrorist attack? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Here's some of that audio from a New York Police Department officer approaching the scene of the attack in Lower Manhattan on Tuesday.
There's multiple people on the ground, Central. We need buses from Houston all the way down to Chambers. I got over 4 or 5 people on the ground. Street. We need buses all the way up to Houston, on Central.
We need buses, as in ambulances. And then sounds like every police car in Manhattan trying to converge on this scene. Here's some of that. So, what do we have to live with here? Joining me now from Washington is Bruce Hoffman, director of the Center for Security Studies, the Security Studies Program at Georgetown University. He was scholar in residence for counterterrorism at the CIA, an advisor on counterterrorism to the Office of National Security Affairs in Iraq in 2004, author of Inside Terrorism, third edition, out in September. Bruce Hoffman, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Daniel Benjamin, director of the John Sloan Dickey Center for International Understanding at Dartmouth College. He's former ambassador-at-large and coordinator for counterterrorism at the U.S. State Department. Daniel Benjamin, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Can I just start with some of the response we've had from listeners about what happened in New York on Tuesday? You know, we put out that we were going to talk about this. We asked the question, do we have to live with this? And right away, you get this range of responses. I mean, one listener who writes in, and the fact that an attack like this doesn't happen every single day on American soil says it all about how big a threat terrorism is. It says, if you think about it, all the people and all the vehicles out there take very little for someone to snap and plow their vehicle into a crowd. This listener says the threat of terrorism is minuscule. Another here, John, says your chances of being struck by lightning are still greater than your chances of being a victim of terrorism in America. But then Anne writes to us, and Bruce, I'll come to you here. She says, wow, interesting to see how quickly people have started accepting this. You know, it's minuscule. Let's not get riled up about it. Wow, let's never accept this. Bruce Hoffman, what do we have to live with here?
I think we always have to live with the shock and the horror that these types of attacks generate, because that's exactly the rationale behind them. And yes, the threat is minuscule. Fortunately, terrorism is not a daily occurrence, is not an omnipresent threat. But we understand why this type of violence, and especially this very devolved type of lone wolf violence, has become so attractive to terrorist groups, because firstly, it's so easy to do. Renting a vehicle, driving it through pedestrians is low on the terrorism sophistication spectrum as one can imagine. But it does generate enormous fear and anxiety, and it does indeed create the publicity and the attention that the terrorist groups thrive on, and that a group like ISIS in particular, who's recently suffered territorial losses and military reversals, is absolutely desperate to prove its continued relevance and being able to elbow itself back into the limelight through a tragedy such as the one that occurred in New York is exactly what the motivation for these acts are.
I mean, Daniel, we've seen this in Nice, we saw it in Barcelona, other places as well. Now we've got it right here. It's the soft target nature of this. I mean, you're just out on a bike path. You're just out for a ride or a walk, and this happens. In the 21st century, in 2017, 18, 19, you counted on out, do Americans just have to live with this threat to soft targets? It's not like they're at a military barracks or they're at Fort Knox or they're even in the World Trade Center. They're just out on the street. Is this something we just have to factor in as a risk factor of life now and live with?
To a certain extent, I fear the answer is yes. If you look at it as a part of a global phenomenon, this brand of terrorism, jihadist terrorism, is going to be with us for quite a while because of the profound upheaval in the Arab world and to some extent the larger Muslim world. And, you know, the state system's in collapse. There are shortages of jobs and everything. And when you have a case like ISIS, there are going to be people around the world watching what they're doing, sympathizing with them, very small numbers of people, and an even smaller number will want to act up. And, you know, this has been the story really for quite a while. I mean, just think back to all the different attempts on soft targets that didn't succeed. You know, we had the just in New York, the Times Square attempt. Times Square, in many ways, a much richer target than this bike path, or the plot against the subways in New York. Mm-hmm. Terrorism almost always goes after soft targets, and I'm afraid that terrorism is a fact of modern life because there's just so many different ways to create destruction and a small number of people who seem to always want to do it.
You know, Bruce, Ian Bremmer, the foreign policy guy who was tweeting yesterday, a lot of people tweeting, of course, the president tweeting, we'll look at that. But this was Ian Bremmer tweeting the lifetime odds of death. Odds of death from heart disease or cancer, 1 in 7. Motor vehicle accident, 1 in 113. You know, gun assault, 1 in 358. Choking on food, 1 in 3,400. The lifetime odds of death from foreign-born terrorists, all forms of attack, 1 in 45,808. That seems small, and yet, that's not, you know, if you're in New York, it doesn't feel small today, Bruce.
No, and there's two points here. One, you've hit the nail on the head. If you're in New York, what I think is missing from a lot of the discussion about Tuesday's terrible incident is, you know, New York has been in the crosshairs of terrorists for decades and has always suffered some form of terrorism because the United Nations is based there, because it's an iconic city, because it's the world financial center. So New York is no stranger to terrorism and has always, even in the wake of the horrific 9/11 attacks, had this, you know, enormous capacity to respond and this enormous resiliency. I think the difference right now is, firstly, ISIS has made it a conscious part of its strategy and articulated this idea of mobilizing otherwise independent, unconnected individuals to carry out these types of attacks. So this is different. And of course, it's when you're talking about a lone individual, there's no communications to intercept, there's no command and control chain to interdict. It becomes much more difficult to prevent and thwart these attacks. So that's, I think, part of what is generating a lot of concern, and rightly so. But, you know, New York is no stranger to terrorism. I think that's a very important point. Secondly, exactly those statistics. I mean, this show is not about people dying from dog bites, for example, mm-hmm. people dying from car crashes. Terrorism, unfortunately, because this is the appeal of its perpetrators, they know that they can thrust their causes and agendas onto everyone's front page or to be the lead story in every news item. So it's a proven way of getting attention. And this isn't complaining how the media covers it. It's just the reality is that terrorism, unlike other threats to our daily existence or other risks, is something that we expect our... And this is the world over. We expect governments to step in and defend their citizens, to stop it, to prevent it, and to make us safe. And it's almost that unrealistic expectation in comparison to having completely risk-free highways that terrorists and their minions seek to exploit because they know they can elbow themselves into the news.
I want to ask if the answer to this is to be more fierce. The president was doing a lot of kind of chest beating yesterday at his cabinet meeting, called for quicker punishment, called people animals here, said American judiciary system is a joke. Here was the president of the United States yesterday.
We need quick justice and we need strong justice, much quicker and much stronger than we have right now. Because what we have right now is a joke and it's a laughingstock. And no wonder so much of this stuff takes place.
A joke and a laughingstock. He's talking about there about the American court system, the judicial system, and he talked about punishing, you know, fast, quick punishment for these animals, said the president.
We also have to come up with punishment that's far quicker and far greater than the punishment these animals are getting right now. They'll go through court for years, At the end, there'll be who knows what happens.
Now, there's a whole lot on the table there. The President of the United States pulling the American judicial system into question like that as a joke, a laughingstock. Daniel Benjamin, is a fierce response. I mean, far quicker and greater. I suppose you could do, you know, hang him on the spot, forget the trial, hang him from the nearest tree. Is fierceness the answer?
No, fierceness is not the answer. The president's completely uninformed about how efficient the U.S. court system is. There have been hundreds of terrorism trials, and the rate of conviction is in the high 90 percentile, 90th percentile, and 90th, excuse me. Mm. What's more is, you know, when we break down our own system, when we contemplate instituting some kind of new measure.
Summary execution? I don't know what he has in mind there.
So what we're doing is throwing out our own values and our own systems and really losing to the terrorists, because that, of course, would inspire lots of other people who feel that we are behaving in an inhumane way itself. Additionally, you know, the president misses one of the really big issues here. Our court system is really effective at cutting down people who want to show that they are holy warriors to size. They're just, you know, small people in a courtroom having the full weight of the U.S. state come against them. And it's been very effective. It's been much more effective than military tribunals to date, which really are wrapped up in crimes from the year 2000 now.
And there you're talking about Guantanamo, where the president yesterday said he'd like to send the alleged attacker here. Today he's backing off on that. I want to ask both of you about whether there's a bright line between what we saw in New York and what we saw in Las Vegas just 1 month ago, with a much higher death toll, also a soft target, a country music concert. Daniel Benjamin, please stand by. Bruce Hoffman, it's great to have you here. Listeners, you can join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
This podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Looking for your next great hire but short on time? You just need the right tools, smarter tools. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 top job boards with just one click. Then their smart technology notifies the most qualified candidates to apply. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. Right now, you can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/OP. That's ZipRecruiter.com/OP. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about terrorism and soft targets after the bike path attack in New York, asking, do we have to live with this? Bruce Hoffman is with us, director of the Center for Security Studies and the Security Studies Program at Georgetown University. He's been in the middle of this for a long time. Daniel Benjamin is with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, director of the John Sloan Dickey Center for International Understanding at Dartmouth College, former ambassador-at-large, coordinator for counterterrorism at the U.S. State Department. He was longest-serving coordinator for counterterrorism since that position was created. You can join us in this hour. What have you been thinking in the time since this New York attack, the bike path attack? Do we have to live with this risk? What would it take to shut it down? Would it take a police state? And how do you shut down a guy with a truck or a shooter in a hotel room in a window, maybe in Las Vegas? I want to listen to the sound of New York trying to grapple with this. This was NYPD Police Commissioner James O'Neill at a press conference yesterday, said when it comes to thwarting terror attacks, the police are not enough.
We need everyone's help. There are more than 8.5 million people in New York City, plus all the people who commute in every day and all the tourists. That's a minimum of 17 million extra eyes and ears and gut feelings. If you see something out there that doesn't look right, if it makes you uncomfortable, you have an obligation to make a call or to flag down a police car.
It was a paintball gun and a pellet gun yesterday or this week that the driver got out of his Home Depot truck with, brandishing instead of firing. A reporter asked Mayor de Blasio and Governor Cuomo whether it was New York's strong gun laws that kept that attacker from getting real weapons and forced him to brandish toy weapons instead, more or less. The mayor said it was an important conversation for another day. But the governor, Cuomo, took that question head on.
I think it is madness, the number of assault weapons that we have in this country. I think it endangers law enforcement. I think it costs us untold numbers of deaths, and I hope one day we'll have a federal policy that actually brings sanity to the gun policy laws in this country.
And you talk about soft targets. That, I mean, obviously, they're all over the place. And in New York, they just keep coming. You've got the world-famous New York Marathon going ahead as scheduled this coming Sunday. Message from city officials, go. Have fun. Don't let the terrorists scare you. But they're beefing up security for the event. Here's NYPD Chief Carlos Gomez laying out the extra measures.
We've added more SAN trucks, more blocker vehicles. It will be the most ever deployed at this event. We more than doubled our observation teams, our rooftop observation posts, as well as our counter-sniper teams from the Emergency Services Unit throughout the boroughs, not just here in Manhattan. And we've also added more heavy weapons teams throughout the city.
More heavy weapons teams throughout the city. Bruce Hoffman, it's been, we talked with you a lot in the days and months and years after 9/11. Now here we are, 2017, 16 years later. I mean, overall, how do you think we're doing as a nation and for New York City in terms of grappling with the threat? I mean, I guess you can call it international and domestic.
Fortunately, there's been nothing close to the 9/11 types of attacks, and I think that's a tremendous success story, that we dismantled the international terrorist organization, Al-Qaeda, that was behind that. We deprived it of what was then its main operating base, and I think we've had, over the past decade and a half, enormous success in preventing the big attacks. I think, ironically, in retrospect, those may be the easier ones to protect, and I'm not by any stretch of the imagination minimizing the challenge in interdicting and preventing those types of attacks. My only point is those were done by large organizations. They had a very clear command and control structure. They had minions who money was sent to, who orders were issued, that these persons undertook training. In other words, there were untold numbers of opportunities that they could have been identified and stopped. I think what we're seeing now is really, frankly, a product of our success in that the terrorist groups have adapted and adjusted to even our most successful countermeasures and are relying, just as you've described, on these very low-level attacks against soft, not hardened targets that have this enormous capacity to inflict pain and suffering, not at the level of 9/11, but certainly enough to catapult the terrorists and their organizations and their causes back in the news and enable them to ply their stock and trade of creating fear and anxiety.
I guess I have to wonder, Daniel Benjamin, do you draw a bright line between what happened in New York this week, the bike path, Home Depot pickup truck, you know, attack, I guess we straightforward have to call it. I mean, he's in the hospital, wants an ISIS flag up on his wall, and what happened in Las Vegas 1 month ago with a much higher death and injury toll, 58 dead there versus 8 in New York. I mean, 8 is terrible, but 58 and hundreds injured as that American shooter just rained gunfire down on the country music crowd there in Las Vegas. Do you draw a bright line between these when it comes to attacks on soft targets, Daniel?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think that there is a inclination to call anything that really appalls us terrorism. And so there were lots of people suggesting that we should call the attack in Las Vegas by Stephen Paddock a terrorist attack. And I think that that would be a mistake. Terrorism, as you know, as we understand it and as it's defined, always involves an ideology and has to have an agenda. So, you know, I think we should be careful about suggesting that an attack like Las Vegas is terrorism. And I think we should also avoid thinking that there's like a ladder of badness and at the very top of it is terrorism, because there are some kinds of crimes, as you suggest, that are just unspeakably horrible by themselves. They don't need to have an ideology attached to them to reach sort of maximal horror. I think that that's an important point. But what I also think is that sometimes there's some erosion on the other side. So, you know, someone like Saifullah Saipov, the alleged, you know, the apparent attacker in New York, it's not like he's part of an organization that's really advancing an agenda. He's acting out and showing that he's part of a global movement against the West, against against its opponents in the Muslim world as well. But we've seen in many cases that these people are also acting out of all kinds of mental defects, mental problems, and there's you know, a little bit of discomfort in calling them terrorists as well. I mean, we will call him a terrorist, but you know, it's a weaker case than it might have been in some other cases. I just want to add one other point, which is that I think that in this case, I'd like to compliment what Bruce said. You know, we need to look at the attack and see what it tells us about the state of the threat. And I have to say that I think that you know, it is a tragic time, and we're all mourning the losses in New York. But this guy was remarkably sort of thoughtless in the way he went about this. There were much richer targets if he was going to carry out a vehicular attack all over New York. Many, many more people on the sidewalk, on the street.
I mean, that's comforting, but also frightening. A smarter or more collected attacker could have had a much bigger death toll.
That is true. But the point is, it was this person with this inability to think through how he would cause the greatest damage who wound up being, you know, essentially the recruit. The other thing I would add is that although ISIS has called for these kinds of attacks, and there are lots of calls from jihadists to carry out individual attacks around the world, in the United States, the situation is quite different from what it is in Europe. And anyone with half a brain who was thinking about what he would do, especially in the month after Las Vegas, would be using guns and not
the difference is the availability of guns here, you're saying, the quite free available.
Oh, yeah. We have such a superabundance of guns. It's not surprising that half, you know, virtually half of all the terrorist victims in the United States since 9/11 were killed in the Florida shooting, and that a significant portion of the rest were also killed in shootings, for example, in San Bernardino and at Fort Hood. The numbers are completely different in Europe, where it's very hard to get guns. And although New York may have strong gun laws, this guy has lived around the country, and he could have driven pretty much anywhere and picked up a semi-automatic weapon.
Yeah. Kirk in Iowa City. Kirk's listening. Thanks for joining us. You're on the air, Kirk.
Yeah. Hey, Tom. So my my question slash point, I suppose, is that there's been a mass shooting in America pretty much every day this entire year. Mass shooting being four or more people being shot by a single person.
Yeah.
And
a Walmart in Colorado yesterday. Three killed in a Walmart yesterday.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times it's, you know, just in some country bar or, you know, wherever it would be, but we don't hear about those. And while it's sad that eight people were run over by a truck, because the guy left a note, it's national news and we have an entire hour about it. But, you know, like all of these other people, you know, more than 1,000 have been shot this year in America. And the difference is that, you know, and it's not just shot, but hurt, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, well, let us note that every time there's been a significantly large mass shooting, we have talked about it at length here. It's not like it's being ignored. But what's your point, Kirk, that they're the same? Were there distinctions to be drawn, or they're not, or not?
My point is that every day, or at least once a week, there's at least eight people hurt or killed by someone in this country somewhere. And we don't talk about it.
Way more than that. Yeah.
It's not jihadist.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, we got it. Kirk, let me take it to Bruce Hoffman. Let me put the same question to you I put to Dan. Do you draw a bright line between what happened on a bike path in New York and what we saw in Las Vegas, or in the many, many, what we classify as mass shootings in this country, Bruce?
They're two sides of the same coin, but they are different. They're two sides of the same coin because, I mean, let's face it, America is an enormously violent society. Last year, there were 17,000 homicides. That was up about 9% from the 2015 figure. The tragedies unfold with people who have completely apolitical motivations, and we still don't know what Stephen Paddock's war in Las Vegas was.
I wish we did. It's such a high death toll. It's weird that we have no sense of why.
Well, and you know, this is an interesting point that Dan brought up too, is that, you know, terrorism and insanity or mental instability are not necessarily exclusive. And that's part of the problem of the threat we face today, is that terrorist organizations are actively courting and seeking out people who are mentally unbalanced, who are unstable, who are looking for a cause, who want to do something that puts their own idiosyncratic mental health or frustrations, yep, or grievances in a wider context. And they seize upon ISIS as that vehicle. But, I mean, and that's the question. If it wasn't for ISIS, would they engage in this violence or not?
But Daniel says terrorism requires an ideology or an agenda. I mean, is nihilism an agenda? I don't know if that's what drove Stephen Paddock, but it seems sometimes like the mass shooters here, they're despairing, they're maybe disturbed. Is nihilism an agenda?
Well, I don't even think it's nihilism, though. I think that in Saipov's case, he actually embraces the ideology of ISIS. It may be completely unsophisticated and very superficial, but nonetheless, he embraces the ideology because that gives his violent act, in his eyes, greater meaning.
Yeah, but does that mean it's not nihilistic? I mean, he was a kind of a drifter in the U.S. His life here, after he came from Uzbekistan, no great shakes. He's an Uber driver. It sounded like he was kind of just at loose ends.
Well, Paddock to me is much more of a nihilist than Saipov, because Paddock inflicted violence for the sake of violence. Saipov tried to put it in a broader context that made what he was doing bigger than himself, and that therefore made him think he's a big man. And this is why he boasts from his hospital bed that he wants to have an ISIS banner up there.
Yeah.
It's because it inflates his importance and inflates the significance of the act, because of its political or ideological content, in a way that Las Vegas doesn't. And this is what ISIS is consciously attempting to exploit and manipulate in the individuals it brings into its web and gets to do these heinous acts of lone wolf spontaneous terrorism.
I mean, but this disturbed factor, if that's what we've got going on here, you look back to 9/11, you had 19 hijackers who did something very choreographed and very deliberate. It's hard to imagine all of them as mentally disturbed or unstable. The distinction gets more subtle, to my mind anyway, when it's Stephen Paddock and this guy in New York. I don't know, Saifullah Saipov doesn't seem so well put together. Let me get a call from David in Duluth, Wisconsin. David, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much. I tend to want to disagree with the person that was talking about the differences between ISIS and terrorism and Las Vegas, as it really does affect people in very much the same way. I've worked with people with PTSD in both the military as well as in community settings.
Worked with them in what way have you worked with them, David?
In treating trauma that they've experienced.
You're a doctor or a psychiatrist or something?
I'm a psychiatrist,
okay.
MD.
Yeah. And?
And I have found that the way that people respond is very similar. One of being put on the defensive and feeling as if they want to attack. And those policies by which we base our response to terror has resulted in a long, long war in both Iraq that's affected many people. And it's affected how we view our communities and the debate between what we need to do. I think that, you know, like he said, a half a mind is right now in Washington, D.C., and not really taking into consideration the judicial consequences of fear.
David, I appreciate your call. I mean, Daniel, this comes back to our response, and what do we do about soft targets? You know, after Las Vegas, the president said, let's not talk about the policy on that right now. Yesterday, he was prepared to talk about policy a lot. After 9/11, we went to war, and more than one. Would we be better off with a lower profile response here? Or is it bring on all means possible because we can't live with soft target fear in the heart of a democracy?
Well, first of all, I was really impressed by the way that New York responded to this by continuing to have the famous Halloween parade. That suggests to me it's the first sign I've seen in a long time that we're actually developing much resilience against the terrorist threat.
In Greenwich Village, just hours after the bike path attack.
In Greenwich Village.
Yeah.
And I do think, first of all, that it's very useful and important for people to try to understand just how rare these occurrences are. I think it's important for them to understand how small the chance is of being caught up in a terrorist attack. And I think it would certainly be helpful if politicians stopped manipulating the threat to make it sound like we face imminent invasion, as Senators Graham and McCain have done at times. And if people, you know, did try to put this, integrate this into a context of understanding how violent our society is, because all those things will reduce the fear, and that is a deterrent. If we are not a fearful society, then terrorists will find it harder and harder to find a way to attack us in a way that will really affect us.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about terrorism and soft threats after the bike path attack in New York and asking, do we have to live with this? Maybe after the mass shooter horror in Las Vegas as well. Bruce Hoffman is with us from Georgetown University. Daniel Benjamin is here from Dartmouth College. They've both been deep in the study of terrorism and counterterrorism for years and applying that thinking to what we're seeing this week and in the last month and more. With us right here, right now. You can join us this hour. What do you think, since the attack on Tuesday? How are you taking this on board? How do you shut down a guy with a truck or a shooter in a hotel room window? What steps do you favor to minimize the risk of this kind of soft target attack? And how much shutting down immigration, closing borders would you consider? How effective would that be? Look at Vegas. How big is the difference between an attack with the ISIS label this week in New York, an attack in Newtown or attack in Charleston or Las Vegas, mass shooters? How do we live with this or stop it? Bruce, Daniel, lots of response online. Ron writes to us on Twitter, study the trends and harden the obvious spots. Skip says, our law enforcement does an incredible job protecting the U.S. from terrorism every day. Gun violence plus domestic hate, far bigger threats. Well, Scott says, you hit on it. Humans are bad at risk assessment. We should be more worried about obesity, cars, guns, etc. than ISIS. Still, and Pack says, I can't stand Trump's constant undermining and ridicule of our civil institutions. Give me due process every day. A lot of people thinking and talking about this. The mayor of New York, very practical about this, talking about policing and how to tighten it up, intelligence, how to do better. Here he was talking with NPR's Morning Edition today, Bill de Blasio.
At the time, who knew if he had a bomb attached to him, how many weapons he had, etc. But yeah, his plan was to do a lot more damage. And it's cautionary, and it reminds us, you know, everything that we do to stop terrorism in this city and in this country, the counterintelligence that we utilize, the preventative measures, the strong, clear physical presence of police at key locations, we need all these tools.
He's talking about tools. The president, one way or another, talking about policy here very broadly yesterday, but this was at his cabinet meeting, saying, let's get tougher. Let's not be politically correct.
We have to get much tougher. We have to get much smarter. And we have to get much less politically correct. We're so politically correct that we're afraid to do anything.
Yeah, like sort of take the binders off. And then Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, South Carolina, telling Fox News, this is just hours after the attack. He's glad that President Trump sees the situation as Lindsey Graham saying, religious war.
He understands that we're in a religious war. And to the American people, we're fighting people who are compelled by their religious views to kill us all. They kill fellow Muslims who don't agree with their view of Islam. They kill Christians and vegetarians, libertarians, Jews, you name it. So we're in a war.
Lindsey Graham taking it right back to religious war. Peggy in Moultonboro, New Hampshire. Peggy, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I am pretty disgusted with President Trump's politicizing this issue and trying to blame all Muslims and all immigrants on what happened. And after the terrible attack in Las Vegas, he didn't blame all white middle-aged men with guns. He didn't get this upset because he didn't want to rile the NRA. But, you know, immigrants, Muslims, people like that, they're easy targets. Well, there's bad apples in every race and every nationality. And I am just disgusted. And he is doing exactly what ISIS wants him to do. He's playing right into their hands.
Peggy, we've got it. We've got it. Let me hold that, if I may, and I appreciate your call from New Hampshire, and get one more right here, and I'll take it to Bruce. Oh, we lost Jody. Well, let me bring it to you right now. What about this sort of span, Daniel? I'll bring it to you first. Between de Blasio talking about, you know, let's do the tools, let's do the policing work, let's get sort of down and gritty with this, and at one end of the spectrum. At the other end of the spectrum, religious war, forget PC, send him to Guantanamo. The president was saying yesterday he's rolled that back a bit. You know, whatever it takes, they're animals. It seems two different attitudes, tones, even approaches, Daniel.
Well, I completely agree. I think that we have lost a lot in this country by our inability to separate a national security problem, terrorism, from identity politics and from a set of beliefs that, you know, is oriented against outsiders, against immigration, against Muslims in general. And I think it undermines us, and it undermines us in terms of our safety in a very concrete way. You know, we get something like 40% of our tips on individuals of concern, people who may be radicalizing from within the Muslim community, from within communities across the country. And when Senator Graham talks about a religious war, even if he concedes that most Muslims are not supportive of the jihadists, he is alienating those people, and he's making them feel more insecure, as the president has done on many occasions, talking about a national registry, talking about immigration bans, and diminishing the likelihood that they're going to cooperate with the authorities if they feel insecure and unsettled. So, you know, in my view, either you want to fight terrorism and you want to make the American people safer, or you want to appeal to your base and ensure your and strengthen your political fortunes.
What about the community aspect of this, Bruce? It's hard to fly blind here. Does that kind of talk turn off the people who could, and many appear to be willing, to help the government keep track of folks who are, you know, getting interested in terroristic violence?
That's absolutely right. The police or the authorities depend on information from the public and from the community, whether it's to solve ordinary crimes of burglaries or car theft, or to unmask a terrorist plot, or to identify an individual that is clearly has extremist views that have crossed the line that they are threatening violence. I think what worries me so much in the rhetoric of the past couple of days is that we're stepping exactly into the trap that terrorists throughout the ages set for political leaders. We think, you know, that terrorists is just, you know, homicidal, maniacal violence without a purpose. Terrorism is fundamentally a strategy of provocation, and what the terrorists are trying to do is provoke some form of overreaction, something that will play into their narrative and justify their violence, but also that will create deep divisions and deep disagreements within the targeted societies of their enemies, and also push otherwise liberal societies to embrace increasingly illiberal solutions to their security needs, and precisely cut off the sources of information from the communities that are the best positioned to help us in preventing these types of crimes and identifying the perpetrators.
What about when the president calls our judiciary system a joke and laughing stock?
I have to agree with Dan. This is just so patently wrong. I think the professionals in the Department of Justice who prosecute terrorism cases have an amazing record, perhaps one of the one of the most successful records of prosecuting terrorist cases and winning long prison sentences as well. Very different in some cases from many of our European allies. I don't think anybody can claim that the Department of Justice or the FBI is in any way lax of prosecuting all forms of terrorism, without reference to who is perpetrating it when violence is involved.
What about just within the judiciary system? What about the implications of the President of the United States calling for the death penalty for this attacker in particular from the White House? I mean, tweeting again and again. I mean, today he said would love to send the NYC terrorist to Guantanamo, but statistically that process takes much longer than going through the federal system. So he's backing off that. But he also says, should move fast, death penalty, all caps, exclamation mark. What are the legal implications of the president saying that?
Well, firstly, if terrorists are seeking to be martyrs, we're handing it to them on a platter. I'm not saying that we shouldn't have a death penalty because that's what terrorists seek, but that has to be part of the factor, and it could have, once again, the opposite effect, or an effect that favors the terrorists' own agenda. But I don't see why. I have yet to see any empirical evidence of what is wrong with the current system, or why our current court system and system of prosecution is in any way failing the people of the United States not to identify these people and to put them in jail, and why we need to resort to extrajudicial activities, especially for low-hanging fruit, for independent lone wolf terrorists who are not at the apex of a terrorist organization, why we have to resort to Guantanamo for them. There's a logic there.
Daniel, could it put the prosecution of Saifullah Saipov at risk, the successful legal prosecution?
I don't think it will affect the prosecution of Saipov, but I think that the president has just handed Saipov's attorneys a very powerful tool for taking the death penalty off the table, in much the same way that his remarks about Bo Bergdahl have also had to be figured into the proceedings in that case. You know, presidents aren't supposed to be weighing in on these things, and if they create circumstances in which a fair trial is impossible or is diminished, then they're undercutting our ability to deal with terrorists. And that's just foolish. That's just completely counterproductive. And I think is once again a case of the president talking to his political supporters and demonstrating how much, you know, he despises these people instead of thinking about what an effective way to deal with this would be.
So let's talk about effective ways of dealing with it, because on the one hand, yes, we have to have a sense of proportion and awareness of everything that happens domestically with mass shootings in this country already, and maybe not separate those entirely. On the other hand, nobody wants to live with this. I mean, we may have to some extent, but nobody wants to. How do you see the tools that are out there to further or more effectively address this? Can we effectively address this kind of soft target threat without building a police state to live in?
So, you know, if you are a realist, you recognize that there's probably an irreducible minimum of violence in our society, and we probably have far more than we need because of the superabundance of weapons that are available. I do think that there are things that we can continue to do that will minimize the chance of events like we saw on Halloween in New York. One of the key things to do, and there are pilot programs going on around the country that empower Muslim communities to do a better job with support from U.S. attorneys and from all kinds of other institutions, to be a better line of defense, to identify people who are radicalizing or at risk of radicalization, and to have interventions by doctors, social workers, clerics, and the like, and to catch them before anything goes wrong. And I think that this shows some hope. The problem is that the government, or the administration, which abhors anything that sounds therapeutic when it comes to terrorism, has cut off funding for this. So it'll be up to non-governmental sources to supplement that shortfall, and I'm not quite sure that they'll be able to. One thing that I would note, though, is, you know, still we have fantastic immigration systems that have ensured to this point, since 9/11, that not a single foreigner under the control of a foreign terrorist organization has come across our borders to carry out an attack. So I think that it's really important that people recognize that and not join in this effort to decry our immigration system and to take draconian measures that would really change that.
Bruce Hoffman, what about that? The White House would balk there, it seems to me, right away. The president didn't want to talk about gun control policy after Las Vegas, but after the bike path deaths, he was ready to go to big policy responses immediately. And the first ones among those that he pointed to were extreme vetting, or almost shutting it down, and immigration restrictions. What about that as a path?
Again, I think terrorists are always trying to provoke some overreaction and trying to get us to pursue policies that, in the heat of the moment or the emotional aftermath of a terrible tragedy, may to some segments sound correct, may resonate, but may not in fact have the practical effects that we think or that is claimed that they will have.
Well, but imagine if Saifullah Saipov had not come from Uzbekistan 7 years ago, he would not have been in New York on Tuesday.
Well, but of course, but he was radicalized in the United States, from what we know, not from Uzbekistan. So until we can look into a man's mind or divine his soul, I mean, how do we know once they come to the United States that they're susceptible to radicalization?
Yeah. You think it's irrelevant then, immigration?
Well, I think that, you know, just as Dan said, we have, I think, very strict immigration measures in place that have successfully prevented known terrorists from entering the country. I mean, this is almost akin to the problem that the defense and intelligence communities face with clearances, is that people are granted clearances, but then over time that they hold the clearances go rogue or decide to disclose it or steal information. And it's, you know, when someone is cleared, they're cleared, but how can you maintain, you know, there may have to be a system with periodic vetting, perhaps, of immigrants until they actually get citizenship. But of course, you know, Saipov is an exception too, in that at least in recent years, I mean, he's someone with a green card holder that's not a citizen, but we've had citizens as well commit these acts. This is the violence, whether it's apolitical violence, mass shootings, or whether it's acts of terrorism, are perpetrated by American citizens just as much as they are, and perhaps more so than other demographics.
Our time is short. What about physical responses, Daniel? Do you expect to see more barriers put up around public spaces, soft targets in the years ahead?
I do, although I would caution that the utility of that is questionable. We'll put up a lot of bollards and protect sidewalks and things like that, and it'll be expensive. And by the time we finished, you know, they may have moved on to a different kind of soft target threat. I was impressed to find that the Department of Homeland Security had been talking to agencies that rent cars and trucks to people and had been trying to build up some awareness. And I think that we'll see more of that. I don't know what the legality is of denying people rentals, but I think we'll probably see some innovation there too, in which, you know, these agencies are allowed to show some more discretion about who they rent to and who they don't. It's a tough one. That's why they're soft targets.
It feels sometimes easier to buy a gun than to rent a car or truck already.
I couldn't agree more.
Oh, and here we are, November now of 2017, 1 month since Las Vegas and the heavy death toll there, just a couple of days since what we saw in New York on a bike path, 5 Argentines, a couple of Belgians there. New York's a very international city, but Americans very awake and alert right now to both a threat and a sensitivity about how we respond to it. Maybe more, Bruce, than when we were talking 15 years ago, 16 now, about 9/11. Very grateful to the two of you for being with us today. Bruce Hoffman at the Security Studies Program at Georgetown University, author of Inside Terrorism. Thank you, Bruce.
You're very welcome.
Daniel Benjamin at Dartmouth College. Thanks for joining us today, Daniel.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.